We can turn to the Old Testament and read Psalm 23, a Psalm of David. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And may God bless that reading to us. Well, I'd like us to just look at the psalm we read, Psalm 23. It's a very familiar psalm to, I'm sure, most of us. If we were in Sunday school or something like that when we were young, and we're liable to have learned it by heart. I certainly learned it by heart a long time ago. And it's also a psalm that's quite familiar at funerals and so on, that even weddings, people choose Psalm 23. It's lots of books have been written about it. Lots of stories are connected to it. There's been many ways of trying to divide it. How to understand the psalm. It's obviously to do with a shepherd, but we have to ask ourselves, what kind of shepherd? Because when in Israel, the king was regarded as a shepherd, so it may not be that it's a person that we call a shepherd in everyday life that is actually in mind here, although that's the illustrations that's been used. It could be just used to describe what an ideal king looks like. Or it could be just the illustration of a shepherd looking after a sheep. Some people think the image of the shepherd runs through the entire psalm. Others think there's three illustrations in it. Verses 1 and 2 is the shepherd, and then verse 1 to 3, sorry, is the shepherd, then verse 4 is the guide, and then verse 5 and 6 is the host. So there's all kinds of intriguing ways of looking at the psalm. And verses 1 and 2, it's a description of relationship. But then verses 4 to 6 is actually a conversation about the relationship. In verses 1 and 2, the sheep speaks about the shepherd. But in verses 4 to 6, the sheep speaks to the shepherd. And there's a world of difference between speaking about and speaking to. And I suppose we could say, if our knowledge about the shepherd, if the shepherd is Jesus, if our knowledge about the shepherd doesn't lead us to speak to the shepherd, then we have to ask ourselves what we think of our knowledge about him. I would like us to ask a simple question as we look at the psalm, and that is, what does it tell us about Jesus? Remember, he himself said on one occasion, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. When we come to the book of Psalms, some psalms predict Jesus, don't they? Some of them are very accurate in their descriptions of him, their prophecies. The psalm before this, Psalm 22, which is a very graphic account of what happened to Jesus on Calvary. The details of that particular psalm can't apply to anyone else. And yet they have things in the, there's things in the psalm that, that it would not have been possible for David to know about. For example, in verse 16, where it says they pierced his hands and feet. I mean, that's a reference to crucifixion, but crucifixion didn't exist when David wrote the psalm. So here he's describing something rather unusual, but he's describing it very accurately. And we might say, well, that's incredible. How can you describe something that hadn't yet been invented? And crucifixion was something that was an horrendous way of putting people to death. But there the psalmist mentions it in verse 16. And then in verse 18, he points out that those who would be crucifying him would cast lots for his garments. And when we turn to the actual accounts of the death of Jesus in the Gospels, we find that that's what happened. The soldiers who crucified him, they divided his garments among them, and for one of them his coat. They didn't want to divide it, so they cast lots as to which one would get it. So there, the psalm again is 100% accurate, describing events that would happen 600 or so years later. The entire psalm is about Jesus. Verses 1 to 21, that's Jesus on the cross. And verses 22 onwards is Jesus after the cross. And both sections of the psalm, they can't describe anybody else. Nobody ever suffered like he did when he was on the cross, and nobody has ever enjoyed the extensive reign of influence that's described in the second half of the psalm. So that psalm's all about Jesus. It predicts him. It describes him. And there's other psalms like that. For those of us who know them, are Psalm 110. It's all about Jesus, nobody else. In Psalm 110, God the Father says, "Sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool." The only person who ever has been spoken to in that way is Jesus. No one else has ever been asked to sit on God's throne apart from him. So it describes him, it predicts him, and it's accurate. There's other psalms that are not so, they're not so much prophecies, but they do picture him. Psalm 1. We know the contents of Psalm 1. The blessed man who reads the word of God. And as a consequence, he's like a tree planted by water, which brings security and refreshment to others. I hope all of us read the Bible today and every day. But which of us become security for others? I mean, that's Jesus, surely, they're describing. In Psalm 15, there's a description of the person who can ascend the hill of the Lord. And Psalm 15, it says lots of intriguing things about the type of person that can ascend the hill of the Lord. He who walks blamelessly and does what is right and speaks truth in his heart, who does not slander with his tongue and does no evil to his neighbour, nor takes up a reproach against his friend. And goes on to say other things about this particular man who can ascend the hill of the Lord. And as we read that description, we have to say to ourselves, well, this is describing a perfect person. There's nobody else that fits this description. And I think the psalm points to Jesus. Until Jesus appeared, when he was born, people must have looked at this psalm and said, who's it talking about? Because it doesn't describe anybody else. Who has always done what is right? And who has always spoken truth in his heart? And who has never slandered with his tongue? I mean, we're sinners. Somewhere along the line, we've done something that's listed there, which of course means that we can't ascend the hill of the Lord in our own right. But Psalm 15 says that if somebody meets that description there of being perfect, then they can ascend the hill of the Lord. If we go to the psalm that's after Psalm 23, Psalm 24, we get something similar. In verse 3, the same question is asked, who will ascend the hill of the Lord, and who will stand in his holy place? And again, we're given verse 4, we're given this description of a perfect life. And the psalmist goes on to say that that individual will receive blessing from the Lord. And then, rather incredibly, in verse 7 of Psalm 24, we discover that this individual, the gates of heaven open to meet him, which is an extraordinary reward for having this perfect life. And there's lots of psalms like that which describe a perfect person. They don't describe sinners. We can't say that every psalm describes us. But there's certain psalms that describe someone who's totally perfect. And for us, people would have sung these psalms down the centuries. None of them could ever say about these psalms, they describe me. Well, no one could actually say that until Jesus started singing them. And once he sang them, he could say, this psalm describes me. He could sing Psalm 15 and sing it truthfully. He could sing Psalm 1 and sing it truthfully. And he could sing Psalm 24, knowing that he's the one who's going to ascend the hill of the Lord, and the gates of heaven are going to open up for him. When we come to Psalm 23, who's it describing? Psalm 23, it has often been noted, is found at a trilogy connected together. There's and people have alliteration and they try and summarize the psalms with alliteration. So they tell us that Psalm 22 is the psalm of the cross, and Psalm 23 is the psalm of the crook, the shepherd's crook, that is, not the criminal, and Psalm 24 is the crown. And people have written books under these three headings. And others see it as Psalm 22 as the sufferer, and Psalm 23 as the shepherd, and Psalm 24 as the sovereign. The problem about having 22, 23 and 24 together is that Psalm 21 is also about Jesus. Because Psalm 21 talks about the King who ascends up to heaven in the start of the and asks God for his heart's desire. And God gives them there in verse 4, life forever and ever. Here's a king who's going to reign forever. And we're told about him in verse 6 of Psalm 21 that he's been made most blessed forever. That he's a totally exceptional king, happy and joyful forever. So as we think of Psalm 23 and Jesus, we can ask ourselves this question. Would Jesus have sung Psalm 23? Or to put it another way, those of us who know the book of Psalms, would Jesus have sung Psalm 51? I don't think he would have sung Psalm 51. Because Psalm 51 is the confession of a sinner. And Jesus wasn't a sinner. So he wouldn't have sung Psalm 51 about himself. That's impossible. But when we come to Psalm 23, there's something quite intriguing about Psalm 23. And that is, there's no confession of sin in it. I mean, is there? The psalmist doesn't say in Psalm 23, I'm a lost sheep. Instead, he just says that he's a sheep. But he doesn't say he's lost. And there's no hint in the psalm that this particular sheep needs to be forgiven. The translation does say in verse 6, mercy, but the word translated mercy just means love. So it's covenant love. So it could just be, surely goodness and covenant love will follow me all the days of my life. People can receive mercy, and it doesn't necessarily prove they've done something wrong. I mean, we can show mercy to people in need. And that doesn't suggest there's anything wrong with them. So whenever the word mercy appears, it's not always an indication that sin has been involved. And as I say, verse 6 can be translated as, surely goodness and love shall follow me all the days of my life. So the psalm, as far as I can see, doesn't have confession of sin in it. Moreover, the psalm, or the person in the psalm, he's got perfect faith, hasn't he? I mean, there's no sign of weakness in his faith. Normally, when we think of the relationship of God the shepherd with his people, we describe ourselves as sheep, and normally we call ourselves silly sheep. But you can't say that about the sheep in Psalm 23, can you? There's no hint that this one who's cared for by the shepherd is doing anything wrong. In fact, he's doing everything right. So it's a rather an usual sheep that's talking here about the shepherd. So who is singing Psalm 23? Would Jesus have sung Psalm 23? And as he sung it, been able to say, this describes me perfectly. Could Jesus, as a youngster, sing Psalm 23? Could Jesus, as an adolescent, sing Psalm 23? Could Jesus, as a man, sing Psalm 23. Could Jesus sing Psalm 23 when he lived in Nazareth? Could he sing Psalm 23 when he was walking round Palestine? Could he sing Psalm 23 when he was on the cross? They're all questions we can ask, isn't it? Maybe he wouldn't be able to sing it on the cross, but could he say it on the cross? These are all, I think they're all questions that we can ask. I read this quote, and it's from Andrew Bonar. I discovered it in Free Church. If you want to say something incontrovertible, just say Andrew Bonar said it. This is what he said. And it's in his commentary in the book of Psalms. The church, he's talking about Psalm 23, the church has so exclusively applied this psalm to herself as almost to forget that her shepherd, the great shepherd, once needed it and was glad to use it. The Lamb, now in the midst of the throne, ready to lead us to the living fountains of waters, was once led along by his Father. I think it's nice to think of Jesus singing Psalm 23. I wonder what it would have been like to listen to him singing Psalm 23. How would he have sung it? Remember, when he rose from the dead, he said to the two on the way to Emmaus, for example, he led them through the Old Testament to things pointing to himself. We can't prove he went to Psalm 23, but I wonder, did he? And later on, he also told the other disciples about how the Old Testament spoke of himself. And it mentions the Psalms in particular. So how would, if Jesus sang Psalm 23, how would he have sung it? Well, I suspect he would have sung it in conjunction with what the Bible says about him. And we'll try and look at that later on. If he sang the psalm, he would have sung it surely in confidence that God would be with him. And he would also, would he not, have sung the psalm looking for consolation in a sinful world? Because where else did he turn? And I suspect he would have sung the psalm when he was contemplating his relationship with his Father. He said something extraordinary. He said lots of things extraordinary, but in John chapter 16, he says something quite extraordinary about this relationship. He says, "I am the good shepherd," and we normally stop there. But he goes on to say, "I know my own, and my own know me." He's the shepherd, he knows his sheep. I know my own, and my own know me. And we could say to Jesus, what do you mean by that? And he goes on to say, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. He's saying, I know my sheep as the shepherd, just as the Father knows me as the shepherd. My own know me as the shepherd, he says, and I know the Father. Just as the Father is my shepherd, says Jesus. And that, I think, allows us to say that Psalm 23 is a song that Jesus would have sung to his Father. So I just want us to go through the psalm and see if it helps us understand the relationship that Jesus had with his Father. I think it's one of the things I like to think about. I'm sure we all do. What was the life of Jesus like? I mean, we know it was perfect. But what is a perfect life like? What does a perfect person do? What does a perfect person think about? Speak about? And I just hope this meditation helps us to see what Jesus was like. Because it's only in the Bible we're going to find out. And this psalm, I think, gives us some insights. He starts off, "The Lord is my shepherd." The word "my" is a very precious word. It describes a possession. The Lord is my shepherd. And when Jesus was singing this line, I mean, how different it would be from us singing it. The Lord is my protector. The Lord is my provider. The Lord is the one I'm depending on, in a sense, what Jesus says here. What was the dependence of Jesus like? Remember, he was perfect. Well, in Psalm 22, there in verse 10, he says something extraordinary about his dependence on his Father. Psalm 22, verses 9 and 10. "Yet you are he who took me from the womb. You made me trust you at my mother's breasts. On you was I cast from my birth, and from my mother's womb you have been my God." When did Jesus, humanly speaking, discover the shepherd care of the Father? Well, that verse, I think, from Psalm 22 indicates it happened at his birth. And that was the story of his life. All the way through, he could say, "The Lord is my shepherd." There's an amazing prophecy of Jesus in Isaiah 42. Which again points to God's care of him. In Isaiah 42 and verse 6 and 7 it says this. And this time it's God speaking to his servant, and the servant is Jesus. So the Father is speaking to his servant. And he says there in verse 6, "I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness. I will take you by the hand and keep you." That's an incredible language for the Father to be speaking to the Son. I will take you by the hand and keep you. That's guard, protect, and so on. That's what a shepherd does. And surely there in that verse in Isaiah, we're being given insight into the promise of the Father to take care of him. And we know from the Gospels that repeatedly throughout his 3 years of public ministry, that Jesus referred constantly to the Father's care. even said to his disciples on one occasion that the Father is always with them. He was able to turn to him at all times. So when he says there in verse 1 of Psalm 23, I would just suggest that when Jesus sang the psalm, he was affirming the covenant relationship he had. We can sing it too, of course. The Lord is our shepherd. And we can sing it too, saying that we've got a covenant relationship with him because we trust in him. But there's something special about Jesus' contact. And then he points out his what God does for him day by day. And imagine Jesus saying, singing in Nazareth, "I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul," and so on. What was it like for sinless Jesus to live in a sinful world? Where did he turn to for refreshment? Where did he go to when he was tired? What did he do after he was tempted? As he faced the various troubles in life that came his way, where did he turn? And we discover that he turned to his Father. In Isaiah chapter 50, it says this about Jesus, another prophecy about him. He says that the Father, the Lord God has given me the tongue of those who are taught. And he has given me this, that I may know how to sustain with a word him who is weary. Morning by morning he awakens my ear to hear as those who are taught. Every day, Jesus turned to his Father and got refreshment, which he then passed on. He passed it on to his disciples. It's extraordinary, isn't it? That the Savior, the green pastures that he was given from heaven, he turned and shared that with his disciples. No wonder they said to him, "Teach us to pray." They had never seen anyone like this before, who just drew near to God and seemed to get so much from God. It must have been incredible being with Jesus and just seeing the answers to prayer that he received. And here in Psalm 23, we're finding that we're pointed to some of the things that, in picture language, of the refreshments that Jesus received. Because there was nothing in the world that could give it to him. He had to get it somewhere else. And he got it from his Father. And then we're told about what Jesus says about, or the psalmist says about the Father: "He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake." Jesus, what kind of life did he live? Every moment, from the day he was born, throughout his childhood, he lived the path of righteousness. When he was 12 years of age, he goes up to the temple, and we know the story. People talk about him being lost, and he wasn't lost. Mary and Joseph had made an assumption that he would be doing something, and their assumption was wrong. But it is interesting, they knew where they would find him when they started looking for him. And they found him, as we know, in the temple. And they say to him, "What are you doing?" And he says to them, "Don't you know that I must be about my Father's business?" He had to be involved in the path of righteousness, even when he was a teenager. And that's the story of his life. He just lived righteously. And when it comes to his moment of his baptism, and we're told that God the Father tore the heavens open in order that he could shout something down. I mean, isn't that really incredible? That the heavens are torn open when the Spirit comes down in the form of a dove, and this voice utters, "This is my beloved Son. In him I am well pleased." And there we have the Father's verdict on the 30 silent years. It's almost as if the Father can't isolate one event because all of them have been perfect. It's the path of righteousness. Wherever he has been, he just lived a righteous life for his Father's pleasure. And the Father led him there along these paths of righteousness according to verse 3. He lived this perfect life. And why did Jesus live a perfect life? Well, he had to offer up a perfect life on the cross. We know about that, even illustrated in the Old Testament with the perfect lamb. There had to be no defects. Had to be no defects in Jesus. And for 30 years he had lived in Nazareth and then a few years elsewhere. And it's incredible to think about, but he never had one wrong thought. He never said one wrong word. He never got it wrong in any situation. He never misassessed a moment, but he always did what was right, everywhere. But why did he do it, in addition to having able to offer a perfect life? Well, when you and I get to the judgment seat, we'll be asked for two things. We'll be asked, "Where's your perfect life?" God will say to us, "You were meant to keep my commandments from the heart. Where is your perfect life?" And God will also say to us, "I know you're a sinner. Where's the penalty for your sin? Who's paid it?" So I need, you need, a perfect life, and we need a payment for our sins. We can't do either. Jesus did both. As Bonar put it, "Upon a life I did not live, upon a death I did not die. Another's life, another's death. I rest my whole eternity." Path of righteousness. Where would be the worst place to live in Palestine? Nazareth. Apparently, if you're on the run from the law, the best place to go was Nazareth. You are safe to hide there. Remember Nathanael? The man in whom there's no guile. He lived in Cana, 6 miles from Nazareth. He said, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" Yeah. Our righteousness was worked out there. And whenever Jesus went to the synagogue in Nazareth and he chose Psalm 23 to sing, he sang it perfectly. Because he was walking in the path of righteousness. But then we come to verse 4. And as we mentioned at the start, in verse 4 it changes. Because instead of speaking about the shepherd, the person who's reciting the psalm, as it were, in verse 4 he starts speaking to the shepherd. And we're now in the valley of the shadow of death. And the reason why it's called a shadow of death is because death was there. It's not just a shadow. Death is lurking around. And it is a bit intriguing that if Jesus is speaking in the psalm, that the item that he chooses to speak to the Father about in the psalm is his death. When he comes to the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. And as we think of Jesus in the valley of the shadow, as I mentioned earlier, he said to his disciples, "You may leave me, but my Father won't." When he gets to Gethsemane and the horrors are starting to come upon his heart, who does he turn to? It's the Father. Can't turn to the disciples, they're sound asleep. But he turns to his Father and he prays to his Father, "If it be possible, let this cup pass from me." Because he's seen the shadow. When he gets to the cross and they nail him on it, who does he speak to? The first saying on the cross is, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." When it comes to the end of the cross for him, who does he speak to? "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." In the valley of the shadow, and in this psalm, he starts speaking to the Father, and he tells him that he's trusting in him, "I will fear no evil." That doesn't mean that evil's not there. He's just saying that whatever evil is there, I won't fear it. And there never was a place of evil, was there, like the cross? We look at it because of the amazing salvation that Jesus provided. But there, all the hosts of hell are massed against him. And there he's going to pay the penalty for our sin. And the one thing we can say about Jesus on the cross is he's very brave. No one has ever, he had no example to go by. I mean, Jesus couldn't look up a manual and say, "Who do I imitate here?" He just had to keep going. And that's what he did. All the way, and even in the darkness, when he's lost a sense of the Father's presence, he still said to him, "My God." It's picture language, of course, but rather strangely, he says in verse 4 that there's comfort in the valley of the shadow. your rod and your staff, no one actually knows what shepherds did with rods and staffs. But the point that is made here about the rods and the staff is that they comfort the sheep. And I think Jesus, if this is describing what happened to him on the cross, he's saying he had joy in the valley. What joy did Jesus have on the cross? Because he did have some. I wonder what he thought when he collapsed and along comes Simon of Cyrene to pick up the cross. I mean, Simon of Cyrene became a Christian. His children are mentioned in the last chapter of Romans. And Jesus sees this man, he's probably not seen in his life on earth before, coming to pick up the cross to help him. And somehow or other, Simon gets converted. I wonder what Jesus thought there when that happened. I'm sure it comforted him. Or how about the criminal beside him? When that man turned and repented. And when Jesus said to him, "Today you'll be with me in paradise," how did Jesus say that? Was it gladly? And I wonder what Jesus thought as he looked down at this Roman soldier below him who was guarding him. And as Jesus understands the development that's going on in that man's mind, and he knows that after he dies, after Jesus dies, this man is going to say, "Surely this is the Son of God." I think all these things are comforts. And in the psalm, Jesus, if he sings the psalm, and he looks forward to the time he's going to be in the valley of the shadow, he sings about the comfort he's going to get there. And if the ones I've mentioned are comforts, then they're beautiful comforts, aren't they? And as we come towards the end of the psalm, verse 6, you know, he says, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life." This is after the valley. I mean, Jesus couldn't say this about his life before the valley, could he? It wasn't just goodness that followed him. The same goes for ourselves. Only goodness and mercy. It's not only goodness and mercy that follows us in this life. Lots of other things are there as well. But there is a place where only goodness and love follow us. And for Jesus, if he sings a psalm, it's after he's been to the valley. And once he comes out of the valley, he's going to be in an environment where there's nothing else but goodness and love. And of course we know that's literally true. And he says, it will last all the days of his life. How long is his life after the valley? Well, Hebrew poetry, apparently, the second line explains the first. And the second line is, "I'll dwell in the house of the Lord forever." That explains the previous one. Where, Where is goodness and mercy going to, or goodness and love going to follow him all the days of his endless life? It's the house of the Lord. It's heaven. And of course, this can't refer to David, because David could not live in the temple. He wasn't a priest. David could never say, I'll dwell in the house of the Lord. Only Levites and others could say that. But when Jesus sang the psalm, and as he looked forward to life after the valley, he could say, I'll be at home forever. And that's where he is. The world of glory after the valley. So did Jesus sing the psalm? I think he did. And I think he sang it in a way that nobody else ever sang it. And he sings it in a way that even we can't sing it. Although some of the things that he refers to there, they're going to be ours, because he did what he did. Because he went to the valley, we'll get to be with him in his house. And that's a wonderful prospect to have. So we can sing the psalm, Psalm 23. And we can sing it knowing how Jesus sang it, and we can sing it the way we need to sing it ourselves. So we can do that just now. We can turn and sing Psalm 23.